From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is in England for a couple of weeks, and I'm here from San Francisco while she's on vacation. On today's Fresh Air, the master of the cuatro, Yomo Toro, joins us for a live concert. Yomo plays the music of his native Puerto Rico, Jibaro. Also today we meet conductor Kent Nagano. He champions 20th century composers, from Pierre Boulez and Olivier Messiaen to Frank Zappa. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead checks out some reissues by another great 20th century composer, Duke Ellington. And television critic David Bianculli reviews a new telemovie on the 1965 Watts riots. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. It appears that the U.S.-led effort to isolate Iraq is gathering momentum. Syria and Pakistan today said they intend to send troops to the Persian Gulf to prevent further Iraqi aggression. Syrian and Pakistani troops will join American forces in Saudi Arabia. Egypt and Morocco have also pledged to send armed forces to Saudi soil because of the threat of Iraq invading the Middle Eastern nation. Meanwhile, the Bush administration's policy of blocking all shipments to and from Iraq by sea is still being worked out, that according to Pentagon officials. As of now, U.S. commanders on the scene have no blanket orders for enforcing economic sanctions. NPR's David Malpas reports from the Pentagon.
Secretary of State Baker said yesterday that interdiction of Iraqi ships would begin almost instantly. But today, the Defense Department says the new policy is not in place yet. Officials say the rules of engagement and other precise operational plans have to be drawn up, including provisions to cover the intricate legal ramifications involved. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams said no immediate confrontations seem to be in sight. But should U.S. commanders encounter an Iraqi ship right now, they would have to ask Washington how to proceed at that time. Another sticking point for military planners concerns coordination of the military forces in Saudi Arabia. Right now, there is no agreement on a joint command. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney will have a chance to help iron that out when he makes another visit to Saudi Arabia at week's end. I'm David Malpas at the Pentagon.
Iraq's ambassador to France said today the Westerners trapped in Kuwait and Iraq will be permitted to leave when the Western military buildup in the Persian Gulf is withdrawn. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from London.
In recent days, Iraqi radio broadcasts have announced that the Western nationals in Iraq and Kuwait are now free to leave. So far, there has been no evidence that that is true, and today, Iraq's senior diplomat in Europe, the ambassador to France, said they will only be released when the United States and its allies pulls its forces out of the Gulf. The ambassador, Abdul Razak al-Hashimi, told a press conference in Paris that the foreign nationals in Iraq are safe. He claimed they are not hostages or prisoners, but he did come closer than any Iraqi official so far to laying out the terms for their freedom. Iraq has been forced to close its borders by the military actions of the U.S., he said. When this buildup around Iraq is ended, he said, the foreigners will be permitted to leave. Asked if he believes an American attack on Iraq is less likely with a large foreign population under detention there, the Iraqi ambassador said, I didn't say that. I'm Mike Schuster in London.
Oil-producing countries are planning a new meeting to discuss how they should handle oil shortages that have occurred since Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S. announced that planned OPEC meeting today, but with very few details. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose over 30 points to 2746.78. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Sedge Thompson. Today, we have a concert with Yomo Toro. He comes from Puerto Rico, but has lived in New York for more than 30 years. He plays the small guitar-like instrument with 10 strings, called the cuatro. For 15 years, Toro performed with the salsa band, the Fania All-Stars, and he's played on more than 150 albums. Last year, he released Funky Jibaro on Island Records. You may have heard Yomo Toro's music without realizing it. He composed and played the theme for Woody Allen's film Bananas. Toro has also been a frequent guest on Sesame Street. He hosted his own TV program on a Spanish-language station in New York City, and he's appeared in the film Crossover Dreams with Ruben Blades. Jibaro is a folk music from rural Puerto Rico. Yomo Toro has stretched the traditional form, as we're about to hear. He amplifies his cuatro and incorporates influences from other forms of Latin music, as well as blues, jazz, and rock and roll. For today's concert, Yomo Toro is joined by Ruben Figueroa on bass and guitar, and Luis Cabrera on percussion. And here they are with Noro Morales, a tribute to the piano player. Welcome to Fresh Air, Yomo Toro.
Hey, thank you.
Noro Morales, the name of the tune.
Noro Morales, great piano player.
Tell me a little bit about the cuatro.
It's the one that I was playing before is a cuatro from Puerto Rico, my island.
And
it's made from the trees.
It's made from the wood of Puerto
Rico. From the woods of the island.
Did you have a cuatro when you were growing up?
No. My father had a cuatro.
Uh-huh.
I was about 6 years, 7 years old. And my father, he was a laborer. He used to work in the choo-choo trains in my town. There was a sugar, big sugar engine there. And my uncles used to work together there with my father. And in the weekends, Saturdays, they get together and they play the music. They play. They sound terrible. But they get together and they play, you know. And then from there, I start. When I was 7 years old, my father used to go to work, and I climb in the bed, you know, in the bed, and, boom, and I go there at the top of the, where the cuatro was hanging, and I started, for 1 year, I was doing that, and I was learning like this. And one day, you know, when I look back, I saw my father standing there, and I fall from the top of the bed there. I was scared he's going to kill me. And then he told me, you climb there again and do what you was doing before. So I was very scared, but I came there and I started playing. And when I looked up at my father, he was crying. I see the tears in his face. So he went down to the yard and he cut a piece of the tree and he started making a cuatro for me. That was the first one that I have in my life, the cuatro. I was 7 years old. And from there, I still, I keep learning up to now.
Do you still have your first cuatro?
It's in my town.
It's in your town.
It's there.
This next song is called Don't Bury My Clothes. What's that mean?
Well, that's a composition that I make, for the next album. And I'm gonna do part of that composition. I want to sing it now because it's like a joke, When I die, don't bury my clothes, because, if I come back again, I want to wear it again, And that's an idea that I have in my mind that it comes out like a very happy thing, So.
Here's Yomo Toro.
Cuando yo me muera, no entierre mi ropa, para cuando resucite yo volvérmela a poner. Cuando yo me muera, no entierre mi ropa, para cuando resucite yo volvérmela a poner. Cuando yo me muera, no entierre mi ropa, para cuando resucite yo volvérmela a poner. Cuando yo me muera, no entierre mi ropa, para cuando resucite yo volvérmela a poner.
Are you freaking with Yomo Toro, the funky jibaro again, el jibaro de la salsa, la soca and the reggae. Pónmeme a comprar un clavo, donde la puede encontrar, para cuando resucite yo me la voy a enganchar.
Cuando yo me muera, no entierre mi ropa, para cuando resucite no volvérmela a poner. Cuando yo me muera, no entierre mi ropa, para cuando resucite yo volvérmela a poner.
Don't nada más, don't bury my clothes,
don't bury my clothes.
When I die, don't bury my clothes,
don't bury my clothes.
When I die, don't bury my clothes,
don't bury my clothes.
When I die, don't bury my clothes,
don't bury my clothes. Cuando yo me muera, no entierre mi ropa, para cuando resucite yo volvérmela a poner. Cuando yo me muera, no entierre mi ropa, para cuando resucite yo volvérmela a poner.
When I die, don't bury my clothes,
don't bury my clothes.
When I die,
don't bury my clothes,
don't bury my clothes.
When I die, don't bury my clothes,
don't bury my clothes.
When I die, don't bury my clothes.
In Philadelphia, don't bury my clothes.
In Philadelphia, don't bury my clothes.
Don't bury my clothes.
When I die, don't bury my clothes.
Puerto Rico,
don't bury my clothes.
New York,
don't bury my clothes.
New York,
don't bury my clothes.
California,
don't bury my clothes.
California,
don't bury my clothes.
California,
don't bury my clothes.
Puerto Rico,
wear my clothes.
America.
Don't wear my clothes.
America.
Don't wear my clothes.
Shut up.
Don't bury my clothes. Yomo Toro with today his good friends and associates Luis Cabrera on percussion and Ruben Figuero on guitar. And we'll be back with more music after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Yomo Toro is here today performing on the cuatro, which is a small 10-string guitar-like instrument from Puerto Rico, made of the trees, the woods of Puerto Rico.
The cuatro is the national instrument of the island of Puerto Rico, which I born there. So I know a lot about that because I born in the middle of cuatro there. And that feeling. But I don't play strictly music from Puerto Rico alone. That's why I was playing that Peruvian thing and all the different. Because, you know, in Puerto Rico, when I was a kid, I used to hear radio station from all the United States. You know, I used to hear those kind of country music and in Puerto Rico, and they came to me. And I hear that I start to love that kind of music. So when I'm playing the cuatro, sometimes you hear that I do something, some tunes and things like that sound familiar, feelings, you know. And that's this reason, because I learn, I hear that music in my little island, Puerto Rico.
So you'd hear the cuatro around your family and then the influence of other worlds,
right,
and countries in the radio.
Right.
The Bacchine is a slow mambo. It's a tribute to the Black Angels. What is
it's not a mambo. It's something like a slow rumba.
Uh-huh.
It's like a, you know, cha-cha, ting, uh-huh, boom. You know, it's the same rhythm.
But a kind of a party?
Like, you know, it's not a cha-cha. It's, you know, it's familiar.
But the piece is about a party, isn't it?
I mean, the meaning of the Bacchine, mm-hmm, is what a long time ago there was a belief in the Caribbean that when a kid die, a baby or a boy or a girl, young girl die, instead of put the coffin in there and I start crying and you know, they instead of that they change, they do different, they bring fruits, they bring musicians and they dance till the next day, and then the next day they bury, you know, the kid. And the belief was that they believed that the spirit, if they do this way, the spirit was going to go very happy.
Here is Yomo Toro and the Bacchine. Thank you. tribute to the Black Angels, Bakine, with Yomo Toro. Son de la Loma means what, sound from the hill?
From Cuba.
From Cuba.
The Montuno from Cuba.
And the Montuno is
a dance. Yeah,
it's a,
you know, they are all music that they playing for dance there, you know, from mountains and the cities and everything. It's a Montuno. And Son de la Loma, in English.
Sound from the hill.
Sound from the hill? Sound from the hill. Okay, say there.
Mamá, yo quiero saber de dónde son los cantantes que los encuentro galantes y los quiero conocer con sus trovas fascinantes que me las quiero aprender. Mamá, yo quiero saber,
ay, mamá,
de dónde son los cantantes que los encuentro galantes y los quiero conocer con sus trovas fascinantes que me las quiero aprender. ¿De dónde serán, ay, mamá? ¿Serán de La Habana? ¿Serán de Santiago, tierra soberana? Son de la loma y cantan en llano. Ya verá, mamá, yo son de la loma. Mamá, yo cantan en llano. Mamá, yo son de la loma. Mamá, yo cantan en llano. Mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano.
Mamá, yo canta en el llano. Mamá, yo canta en el río. Mamá, yo canta en el puente. Mamá, yo son de la loma.
Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano.
Para papá, papá, para papá, papá, papá. Son de la loma, canta en el llano. Que ellos son de la loma, yo canta y canta en el llano, en el llano.
Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano.
Son de la loma, son de la
loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano.
Ay, mamá.
Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano.
Brrr.
Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano. Son de la loma, mamá, yo canta en el llano.
Ajá.
Son de la loma, mamá.
Shut up.
Muchas gracias.
A la orden.
Songs from Puerto Rico, the Caribbean, South America. Yomo Toro, cuatro. Ruben Figueroa, guitar and bass. Luis Cabrera, percussion. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.
There was this tune that I'm going to play now. It's a big hit in the whole South America. It's a very known melody. And the title is about the star.
Southern Star, here again,
right.
Yomo Toro.
Estrellita del Sur. Dice.
Thank you. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Today, Kent Nagano, conductor and champion of classical music of other centuries and of our own. He works with Frank Zappa to conduct his symphonic works and leads the orchestras of the Lyon Opera and the Berkeley Symphony. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead begins a two-part look at the music of Duke Ellington. And television critic David Bianculli reviews TV's fresh look at the Watts race riots 25 years ago this month. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The U.S. State Department says about 500 American citizens have managed to get out of Kuwait since that nation was invaded by Iraq 12 days ago. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
All last week, the State Department estimated that 3,000 private U.S. citizens were in Kuwait. Today, spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler put the figure at 2,500. She would not say how the Americans have managed to leave, saying she did not want to compromise the methods they're using.
There are any numbers of ways that Americans and other foreign nationals are getting out, and we have been saying every day that they are indeed getting out. They are. So that's the reason for our reflection and the decrease in the number.
But getting out is not easy. U.S. officials say 40 to 50 carloads of Americans were stopped at Kuwait's border with Saudi Arabia today. U.S. Embassy personnel and dependents are apparently being allowed to leave. The State Department says there are adequate supplies of food and water in Kuwait. In Baghdad, however, food is beginning to be in short supply, the State Department says. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Defense Secretary Richard Cheney will visit Saudi Arabia on Friday. Defense officials said today Cheney will stress U.S. willingness to use military force to protect the Saudis. The trip will be Cheney's second to Saudi Arabia this month. Right after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, Cheney met with Saudi King Fahd. Fahd then invited U.S. troops and aircraft to protect the kingdom. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State John Kelly met with the Egyptian foreign minister to discuss the Gulf crisis today. Egypt has rejected Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's peace proposals. Linda Gradstein reports from Cairo.
The assistant secretary is on a trip around the region to Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. He said Egypt has been in the forefront of international and Arab efforts to resolve the Gulf crisis.
We share the same goals, the immediate withdrawal of Iraqi forces from Kuwait and the restoration of the legal government of Kuwait.
Kelly also said he had seen the Emir of Kuwait in Saudi Arabia. Egypt today responded to Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's latest peace initiative, linking Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait to Israel's withdrawal from the occupied territories. The initiative is not propaganda, said Boutros Ghali, the Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, but it goes against decisions reached by the Arab nation. The Egyptian press today scorned Saddam's offer, calling it a bluff and empty words. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Cairo.
In Colombia, there are fears of a new round of drug-related violence today after police killed a top drug baron over the weekend. In the city of Cali, gunmen firing from a car shot dead a former congressman. In the Caribbean coastal town of Barranquilla, a former high court judge was shot by assassins on a motorcycle. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial rose 30 points to 2746.78. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, I'll talk with conductor Kent Nagano. He champions modern music from Frank Zappa to Pierre Boulez. But first, some jazz. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says listening to music for a living is a cushy job on normal days, but it never gets better than when he sits down with a stack of records by pianist and composer Duke Ellington. This week and next, Kevin samples recent Ellington reissues. Today we hear how the late band leader worked with two great trumpeters.
Some jazz band leaders keep their music fresh by changing personnel a lot, but not Duke Ellington. He liked to keep the same musicians around, and a few key players were with him for decades. One reason they stuck with him is that Ellington never wasted a good soloist. He'd seize on the most striking aspect of a player's style and build whole chunks of his repertoire around it. In a sense, he made their personal quirks immortal. The Ellington Orchestra's first great voice in the late 1920s was trumpeter Bubber Miley. He got stunning vocal effects using his plunger mute. That's Bubber Miley on one of Ellington's first great compositions, East St. Louis Toad Low. It's on a new anthology from the MCA label called The Brunswick Era, Volume 1, which is loaded with Miley solos. It's a pretty good set, though there's not much excuse for a CD compilation that's only 48 minutes long. The great cliche about Ellington is that he wrote for specific players, but that's only partially true. Once his band's style had coalesced around a few great musicians, like Miley, Ellington kept their sounds as part of the mix even after those musicians left. Bubber Miley, who died young, was only with Ellington for a few years, but his brass growling remained a cornerstone of the band's vocabulary. For instance, here's trumpeter Cootie Williams with Ellington in 1965. Different trumpeter dominates another Ellington reissue. Like Bubber Miley, he was influenced by the early jazz brass man King Oliver. Ellington and Louis Armstrong recorded together just once in 1961, with Armstrong playing and singing Ellington standards, backed by Duke on piano. The complete results of that two-album session are now out on a CD from the Roulette label. Critics often knock this session because Ellington sat in with Armstrong's band instead of the other way around. Still, they hook up well, partly because Armstrong's clarinetist, Barney Bigard, had once been a key member of the Ellington band. And it's also because Armstrong's buoyant rhythm had left its mark on Ellington along with everyone else. Satchmo influenced Duke's writing from outside the band. When Armstrong plays Just Squeeze Me, an Ellington number from the early 40s, he makes it sound like it had been written especially for him. You can tell Armstrong likes that tune because he plays it straight. He takes a different approach to Ellington's classic Mood Indigo. Its distinctive sound depends on a careful blend of trumpet, clarinet, and trombone, but the free way Armstrong phrases the melody leaves the other parts exposed. It's not what Ellington had in mind when he wrote it, but it's a great example of the tension that always exists in jazz between composition and improvisation. Duke Ellington's genius is about more than his ability to use great soloists. It's also about his mastery of orchestration. A couple of other new reissues spotlight that side of his music. I'll play you some of them next time.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed new Duke Ellington reissues on the MCA and Roulette labels.
Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
This is Fresh Air. Although he's conducted in New York, Boston, Paris, London, Amsterdam, and Stockholm, it's the Berklee Symphony in California that Kent Nagano has called home since 1979. He's also the music director of the Lyon Opera in France. Nagano's training is classical, but he's known as someone who likes to program complex modern works, ranging from Mahler, French composer Olivier Messiaen, to Frank Zappa. I asked him if he always intended to stretch the usual repertoire.
I can't say that it was totally premeditated. I did have training as a composer. So because of that, when I approach a score, I'm trying to approach a score and bring to it a very objective analysis of the score in terms of what it brings, but also because of my background, I go ahead and attach a very strong subjective evaluation of the score. And I think it is important for an artist to, or a performer, any kind of performer, to actually feel free and secure and also be responsible enough to do enough research such that you can lay down a subjective opinion and have it be the basis for an interpretation. Since I don't draw any particular boundaries in terms of time, when it was written, period, or whether or not it happens to be in vogue, that just by definition means that sometimes I'm going to be performing pieces with great enthusiasm that no one's ever heard of before. It hasn't been the intent to bring unusual repertoire. My intent has been to bring music of the highest quality to audiences with the utmost respect for audiences and to perform them at the highest level possible.
How did you first make the connection with Frank Zappa?
The connection with Frank Zappa came from, well, indirectly from Pierre Boulez. One of the first times that I went over to France, the big dream of mine was to see the IRCAM Center at the Georges Pompidou Center, because I had heard so much about what Pierre Boulez was doing there. And a friend of mine was head of the music research, Todd Macover, who's a composer. We had gone to school together. And he had several times invited me to come down and just see what sort of activity was going on down there. So I went down, and I took a look at a list of various composers who had been scheduled for two seasons in advance. Now, on this list were some composers who were given a commission to write a piece, And for others, there were composers that were going to be premiered for the first time, have their music played for the first time there at the Georges Pompidou Center. And among the composer's name, at the end of the list, because his name starts with Z, was Frank Zappa. And I was absolutely astounded. And I asked Todd, why is Frank Zappa's name here? And he said, oh, well, Pierre Boulez was approached by Frank Zappa to perform some of his music, which evidently is quite difficult. Boulez liked it enough so that he programmed some of the music onto the regular Ensemble Intercontemporain season. Well, it stuck in my mind, I suppose, because even though I was not at that time a Frank Zappa enthusiast, when I came back to the San Francisco area where I was living at that time, shortly thereafter, Frank Zappa came through on tour. So I just gave a call to his sponsors to find out if I could somehow talk to him about his music. Not only did I receive a response, but Frank called me himself and said, come to the rock show. And during the intermission, he would show me some of his scores. So I wasn't a rock enthusiast at that time either, so it was a very, very strange culture shock for me to go to a rock concert with all this very loud, extremely dramatic music. And to go backstage to take a look at the life of a rock star. I'd never seen it before. But we met briefly. He gave me a handful of scores, and I took a look at them. And they were indeed very, very difficult, very complex, but interesting at the same time.
What stood out for you in looking at them?
Certainly it was the way that he had codified through normal notation his free use of rhythm. It was a combination of extremely restricted rhythm in that it was notated very precisely, but if performed properly and accurately, it would give the impression of total freedom of pulse. You would be somehow unaware of where the normal pulse was because the polyrhythms were so extreme and so constant. So I returned the scores, and I attached a note that I felt some of the scores were really interesting, and maybe someday, I could put together a performance of one or two of the pieces in the Bay Area. That was basically how the contact was made, but I didn't hear anything from Frank for a long time, and I basically forgot about it all until I got a call out of the blue one day asking if I would go with Frank and his entourage and record a series of records with the London Symphony. And that was how our friendship, which goes on even today, was really first started.
When you hear music that you've worked with in performance in a hall on a disc, are you disappointed? Are you satisfied with the sound that then comes out of a CD or a cassette or a record?
Actually, Serge, that question is, I think, going to get me in a lot of trouble because I have an unusual attitude towards recording. For a long time, I didn't record at all. Record the actual medium of recording itself. It's a loaded medium in that it's become so abused by media today and by marketing agents using the recording as almost a type of a calling card these days or a type of a billboard, a source of publicity. The more records you make, the greater artist you are. But I think there was a time when if you were an artist who made a recording, it did say, or perhaps reflect in some way, that you were one of the leaders within your field. Now, today, that's certainly not at all the case. You can You can pay for your own recording and have it done in these so-called vanity labels. Essentially, that's what Frank Zappa did with his music. He hired an orchestra, hired a conductor, and paid for recording time and produced his own record album.
Where do you think the sense of self-assurance about yourself came from? I guess I read it as self-assurance, that some people in the music business would want to have a stack of records, of credits, those calling cards as you referred to. But you seem quite satisfied to do just a music performance absolutely well, whether it's just the orchestra hall that hears it.
The actual recording industry has changed a lot. And unfortunately, you can buy a lot of terrible recordings, even by great artists, because under the conditions of which they've been recorded. And, you know, it's no one's particular fault, but I think the financial realities of how to create a recording these days have, and the budgetary requirements have changed in such a way that the end result can actually not be something that you can be proud of. And that strikes me as something horrific, if you recorded something and it's there forever and it doesn't represent truly what you feel inside. That to me would be the greatest disservice to both yourself and to audiences, whoever would listen to it. I have a different attitude towards the recording medium also in general. I like to record in the studio, and I don't like so much live performances, because I make such a big difference in my mind personally between the experience of going to a live concert and what the function of that is. That's the real artistic exchange, is going to a live concert. Listening to recording is not, it really isn't. The real way that you make the acquaintance of someone is sitting across the table and talking to them, having dialogue, having an exchange, a living exchange. Yes, you can tell something about a person by looking at their photograph, but it doesn't tell you really on many dimensions what that person is like as a person. And the same way is with a piece of music. You can tell something about a piece of music by listening to a recording of it, but you can't tell anywhere near the whole scope of the piece unless you're hearing it being performed by living people in living time in a living hall, as a living person who's participating and reacting emotionally, spiritually, and physically to what's going on in that space at that particular time.
Conductor Kent Nagano. Here's an excerpt of Kent Nagano and the Berklee Symphony Orchestra performing Messiaen's Un vitrail et des oiseaux, A Stained Glass Window and Birds. This is Fresh Air. Later here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered, and host Linda Wertheimer has joined us to give us a preview. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Sedge. We're going to be talking to some of our reporters who are in the Middle East. We have a reporter with the American troops in Saudi Arabia, another who has just been on the carrier Independence, and we'll have reports from both of them. We're going to take a look at Britain's decision to join the president in the effort to interdict ships to and from Iraq. We will look at the economic impact of what has happened on Japan, and we'll have a half-hour special on something which is in all our futures, traffic.
Thank you, Linda Wertheimer, host of All Things Considered, that we can hear later here on National Public Radio. In August of 1965, race riots destroyed much of Watts in Los Angeles. Now, 25 years later, the TNT cable network is showing a new made-for-TV movie about the Watts riots. It's called Heat Wave. Television critic David Bianculli has this review.
Most docudrama filmmakers screw up by spending too much time recreating news footage and too little time creating or recreating characters that are worth caring about. Heatwave doesn't make that mistake. It's written by historian Robert Lazarow, so the facts are believable. But so are the people whose stories he tells. First of all, Heatwave chooses the single best perspective from which to dramatize what happened in Watts on those hot August days and nights. The usual points of view, the police chief, the mayor, and other power brokers, are tossed away. Instead, Heatwave tells its story by sticking with a young black man named Robert Richardson, a Watts resident who works in the mailroom of the Los Angeles Times. When the riots break out, the Times editors, played by David Strathairn and Adam Arkin, realize that their all-white reporting staff can't get access to Watts without risking attack. That's where Richardson, played by Blair Underwood of L.A. Law, steps in.
Thomas, I live in Watts. It would be very easy for me to enter the riot area and report back everything I see.
Who the hell are you?
This is Richardson from the mailroom. I took journalism courses in college. I can quote you Ambrose Bierce and Edward R. Murrow chapter and verse. I'm a messenger at this paper because it was the only way I could get a job.
Listen, kid, because you're a Negro does not make you a reporter. I need a journalist, not an opportunist. I cannot use you.
You can't use me? I just saved two of your white reporters' asses.
What about Wilson at UPR?
What about me?
You're not qualified.
All due respect, sir, I'm the only one in this entire building who is qualified.
Richardson does get the job, of course, and his articles focus on the individual faces and stories that make up the angry mob. Heatwave does the same thing. But, though all its characters are drawn into the Watts uprising, not all of them are angry. In fact, two are absolutely charming. Cicely Tyson plays Richardson's pious grandmother, and James Earl Jones plays a member of the church who patiently but persistently woos her. Their scenes together are delightful.
I know that today is a family day, Ruth Anna, and I don't want to bother you, but I had to come over here and tell you, you look absolutely radiant.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. I certainly appreciate the compliment.
The church is having a barbecue for us older folks who have lost our beloved ones.
Uh-huh.
And I would be honored if you would escort me to the festivities.
It is my understanding that the barbecue in question is for those looking to re-enter the matrimonial bond. That, Mr. Jackson, does not include me.
Kevin Hooks directs these quiet scenes as effectively as the riot scenes. And by focusing on Richardson, Heatwave gets to explore his particular moral dilemma. Whether he is an opportunist, or whether, by reporting and writing the story for a white newspaper, he's putting the riots in a perspective that no one else could. It makes for a powerful TV drama, though for sheer intensity, nothing matches the actual news footage which is interspersed throughout Heatwave. But this docudrama does what Richardson did. It tells the story well and puts it all in perspective.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landerall. The engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. For Vacationing Terry Gross, I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, reporters Ralph Blumenthal and E.R. Shipp talk about covering the Tawana Brawley case for the New York Times. Also, we meet in a dark, noirish alley crime novelist James Ellroy. That's just a hint of the next Fresh Air.